All right, you're listening to the Dan Time Podcast. 52 straight weeks of Dan's and other exciting guests. I'm your host, Dan McArdle. Thanks so much for listening. I appreciate you leaving a star rating. And if you enjoy the podcast, tell a friend about it. My guest today is Dr. Glenn Fleisig, the leading authority on biomechanics and pitcher injuries in baseball for over three decades. Dr. Fleisig serves as the biomechanics director at the American Sports Medicine Institute, or ASMI, in Birmingham, Alabama. It was in 1987 when renowned orthopedic surgeon Dr. James Andrews hired him to start ASMI. Dr. Fleisig holds engineering degrees from MIT, Washington University, and he earned his PhD at UAB. He's also an adjunct professor at UAB. Dr. Fleisig is an advisor to both Major League Baseball and Little League Baseball. He founded the American Baseball Biomechanics Society, and he also serves on the Medical and Safety Committee for USA Baseball. His expertise in sports injuries is continuously sought by major media outlets. Dr. Fleisig has been featured just this year alone in articles published by The Athletic, Sports Illustrated, and the Dallas Morning News. He's featured on an episode of the Book of Joe podcast with three-time Manager of the Year Joe Maddon and three-time Sports Writer of the Year Tom Verducci. On this episode, Dr. Fleisig and I talk about the ulnar collateral ligament, or UCL, some knowns and unknowns about pitch velocity, and how and why the push for everyone to throw harder has extended across all levels of baseball, not just the big league level. Dr. Fleisig also discusses topics such as the pitch timer and whether that has played a role in the steady increase in elbow injuries. And finally, we learn about what teams and Major League Baseball are doing or plan to do to fix this epidemic. Dr. Fleisig is the recipient of all major awards in sports biomechanics, including the James Andrews Award for Sports Medicine 2008, James Hay Award for Sports and Exercise Biomechanics 2013, the Borelli Award from the American Society of Biomechanics in 2021, and next year in Qatar, he will deliver a presentation and accept the Dyson Award from the International Society of Biomechanics. Dr. Fleisig has authored and co-authored more than 200 scientific publications. He's also given over 300 presentations at scientific conferences throughout the U.S. and the world. You can follow Dr. Fleisig on Instagram by searching The Biomechanical Man. It is my pleasure and a great honor to introduce him to you today. Folks, it is Dr. Glenn Fleisig time. Really big deal to have on the show. We have a mutual connection with Dan Weinrib. If you've missed those episodes, Dan's appeared on two previous episodes. Go back and check them out. But today I'm welcoming Dr. Glenn Fleisig. Dr. Fleisig, thank you for making time to be here today. How are you doing this afternoon?
Doing great, Dan. Pleasure to be here.
It goes without saying that you really are the leading voice, not just the expert in this industry, but quite relevant as to how it has evolved over the past, say, 30-plus years. We were talking before this episode started. If you're a baseball fan and you're starting to notice that versus 5 or 10 years ago that the pitch speed, you know, your closer comes in, he's hitting 99, 100, 101, 98, 99. We're starting not to bat an eye at that. And it's not just, I remember 15 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago, Aroldis Chapman, if guys were torching the radar gun at that speed, it was one or two or three of them. And now it's so prevalent that we just, when you see a finesse pitcher, or they used to call him a crafty lefty, it's an anomaly. And this is not without its consequences. If you follow baseball and you follow your teams and the injury reports, you're starting to see this is becoming quite a problem. How did we get here? And I don't know that there's really any quick fix to this It's kind of a systemic issue. Is that correct?
So, yeah, what you just spoke about there, Dan, I painted the story. It's both exciting and at the same time concerning, okay? As a sports fan, as you mentioned, it's exciting to watch some guy pound his hand into the glove, come out, and they throws it past the batter who looks frustrated, and you look up on the scoreboard and it says 100 miles per hour, and the pitcher throws his fist in the air. That's exciting. On the other hand, it's not exciting to click on the website the next day and find out that your favorite team just put your pitcher on the injury list or he has to have Tommy John surgery. So we're talking about two things, how fast pitchers pitch and how many injuries they have. And the implication or the assumption that you are making is that the number of injuries is related to the velocity. So I just want to address that first of all, Dan. First of all, the first question is, are pitching injuries up or is it just our illusion or impression? The answer is, it's true. The pitching injuries are up at the major league level. We have clearly there's data on how many pitchers are on what's called the IL, the injured list. And we also have data about what's happening in the minor league baseball, college baseball, and high school baseball, even down to youth baseball. And unfortunately, since the time you were just talking about 10, 15 years ago, pitching injuries at all these levels haven't continued to increase. So there is an issue here. I do want to say 15 years ago, about 2010, they talked about, we noticed at that point an increase in the number of amateur pitching injuries, high school, youth, college. And so myself and colleagues at Major League Baseball, at ASMI, elsewhere, we studied the issue, again, about 2010. What's happening? What was happening there was that pitchers, baseball players, were starting to play year-round. And this was the first generation back in 2010 or so, 2005, where kids would play one sport all year. Hey, I'm not a kid. I'm a baseball pitcher. I'm not a kid. I'm a gymnast or whatever. And that's good. You know, people have their favorite sport and their private instructors in every town, and they would have the opportunity to play all year round. And, you know, like here in Birmingham, Alabama, where I live, where you grew up, the weather's nice and you can play outside year round, pretty much year round. So we scientifically studied all that. And about 15 years ago, 10 years ago, we made some rules. It's on the website pitchsmart.org. This was by Major League Baseball, USA Baseball, ASMI. And we changed the playing field, literally, that pitchers were no longer limited to the number of innings in youth baseball, but pitch counts. And that is what kids today are growing up with. Anyway, it worked for a while, Dan. The rise of pitching injuries at all levels stopped going crazy for a few years back in 2015 to 2020. But then in the last 5 years, injury rates are going up and crazy. And then what we found out scientifically, it is what started this conversation, that the number of pitching injuries have been going up with pitch velocity. And so I'm going to break that down for you a little here. What is happening is we do biomechanics research. We can talk a little more about what that is. But we can measure the forces and torques in the arm and see how much stress there is. And there's some other labs in the country that do so. And the data clearly shows that how much stress in your arm goes up, stress in your arm goes in your elbow goes up with pitch velocity. It's not necessarily one-to-one, but faster pitches are more torque and therefore higher chance of injury. So that's where we're at. We have velocities are going up. It's exciting. People want to watch it. Teams want pitchers to strike people out, but you're also pushing the body to essentially what the ligament can't handle.
Let's talk for a second about the UCL. I know sports fans, they hear about this guy went down with an ACL tear or UCL. And most fans, I think, see that a player has landed on a 10-day IL or in football, whatever, 60 days. And we don't really chase down more. I mean, some serious fans do want to find out exactly what's going on. But talk about this ligament. And what I understand, it has very poor blood flow by design.
Right. Well, first of all, yes, ligaments, have poor blood flow compared to muscles. So when you work out, what happens is when you work out, you are pushing your muscle and stretching it and fatiguing it. If you take good food and nutrition and hydration, your muscle builds up and it repairs and becomes stronger because it has the good vascularity, the good blood flow, and you can make your muscles bigger and stronger. Unfortunately, ligaments have poor blood flow, including the elbow ligament, and therefore you can't really super strengthen your ligament. As your muscles build up, you really don't build up your ligaments proportionally as much. Also, if you hurt your muscle and you rest and recover with the good blood flow, and if you eat good food, it'll repair. The ligament, the blood flow is not as good. So if you tear it during baseball pitching, you're in trouble. It's a hard road for recovery. So you want me to tell a little more about what the UCL really is? And let me just explain a little more medically without getting too depth. Ligaments attach one bone to another. You accidentally said ACL before in football, but ACL is the big ligament in the knee. In football, if some guy tackles some other guy and his knee buckles, he might tear his ACL in his knee. That's bad, and your knee is unstable. You have to have surgery, and then you could come back. Likewise, in baseball, no big linebacker tackles you. You just do it yourself. But the ulnar collateral ligament is a little ligament on the what's called the medial aspect of the elbow, which is, if you put your arm down to your side, it's the part of your elbow that touches your hip. That's where your medial lateral ligament is. When you bend your arm back like you're pitching and the palm is face up to the sky, that part of the elbow is also faced up and it's really has a lot of tension in it. And the poor little UCL, ulnar collateral ligament, is really stretched out to its max. And so it's teeny, Dan. The little ulnar collateral ligament is like a little rubber band type material. Maybe the functional part is about an inch long or not much longer than that. And it's not too wide. And it's really thin, like a rubber band. And so that poor little ligament keeps getting stretched out. And if you're putting too much on it because you're too big and strong and throwing too fast, the ligament gets little tears in it and tears faster than it can repair and you blow out your elbow.
And the type of athletes and pitchers that are most susceptible to injury, I've been doing a little bit of research on this, are not so much the pitchers that have, you know, a 97 mile an hour fastball and then they change speeds down to 86 with their curve or their changeup, but it's those pitchers that do not have a lot of daylight between their velocity. Is that correct?
That is exactly correct. Thank you. And that's a drum I've been beating here at ASMI. We've done some actual research, a little more granular and looking at the details. If one pitcher pitches 5 miles per hour faster than another, chances are he's putting more stress on his elbow than the other pitcher. But it's not always the case. However, for every single pitcher, if you have a variety of speeds on your fastballs, let's say, a 5 mile per hour range, you are definitely putting less stress on your UCL when you throw the slower fastball than the faster fastball. So the guys who are in most trouble or highest risk of injury are the guys who are putting the maximum stress on the UCL every pitch, which are the guys who are throwing every pitch with max effort. And so that is a kind of a new philosophy that's happened in Major League Baseball and Minor League Baseball and Amateur Baseball in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, which pitchers got promoted? It was the guy with the good ERA and the good strikeouts or what and few walks. Now who gets promoted? It's the guy with the high radar gun speed. Whether it's a pitcher from Latin America who wants to be signed in the pros or a high school pitcher who wants to go to college, there's a growing emphasis on just raw speed, pitch velocity, compared to actual performance, how few walks you have, things like that. And so this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Teams are rewarding speed at all costs. And as a result, we're getting faster pitchers because that's who they're picking. And as a result, we're getting guys who throw every pitch as hard as possible and blow out.
Going back to those 100-mile-an-hour fastballs, I mean, the number of guys that could throw 100 miles an hour multiple times in one game was really, it was not something you saw very regularly. Even if you went back 20 years ago, it was something you would pick up the phone and call your friend who also loves baseball, say, "Hey, did you hear about this guy?" And now you don't even, it's not something you bat an eye at. But I was reading this statistic. The number of pitches thrown 100 miles per hour or more has more than tripled in just 5 years, from about a little over 1,000 pitches in 2019 to 3,800 in 2023. It's just staggering. And I don't see anything to indicate that that trajectory is going to change.
Right, exactly. So first of all, I want to point out one intricate detail about those numbers. If you look at the top fastball velocity now compared to 5 years ago, compared to 10 years ago, the top velocity hasn't changed much. What's changed is the average fastball velocity is now a higher number, and essentially the number of pitches, like you said, at 100 miles per hour, it's a crowded ceiling, and it's just gotten more crowded at the top. So the human ability seems to be maxed out at about 100 miles per hour or so, 100 miles per hour plus or minus a few more. So it's just getting crowded there. It doesn't seem like the body can possibly go faster than that without the elbow blowing out immediately. But every team has pitchers in their organization who could throw near that speed. And and they're really pushing it to their limit.
Dr. Fliasek, I was also reading an article, I believe this is in Sports Illustrated from April this year, where you said, "I've been banging the drum for years about this. I've been saying that the body cannot withstand this. Strategically, what is it that you want? Do you want to be someone who can throw 100 miles an hour for two games, or someone who can pitch at a tick lower, who can pitch for a full season?" Without outright saying it, teams have been chasing velocity. If you really think about it, and I could kind of spiral off on another end of this, and you start thinking about young guys and their futures, and they've been playing their whole lives and sacrificing so much, and they get there, and then their career could be over in about 2 or 3 years. And then it's almost like we've dehumanized these young men, and just there's such a high inventory of pitchers who can perform at this level that I guess teams are just sitting there saying, "Well, we've got the supply. Why do we need to change anything?"
Right. This is a common thing in a lot of professional sports, in baseball for the pitchers, in the NFL football for running backs. Let's just get the most out of this guy and then get the next guy in the heap to come up. You know, I don't want to be sad. I think there is some optimism. The teams, the major league teams, as a competitive market, they want to win. And it doesn't matter how many guys you have who throw fast if they're all having surgery and not pitching, right? So I think teams need to come to the understanding that to maximize their performance, they, like I said in that quote in Sports Illustrated, they need their pitchers to survive on the field. So I think strategically, teams all have what's called data analytics. They all have experts looking at the numbers, and they have to come to the realization that they need their guys healthy. So I think there'll be some team assessment where there are going to make some decisions. Likewise, I also think there are going to be some rule changes or guidelines changes to kind of make this happen. Now, as you know, Major League Baseball a couple of years ago had a different problem. I don't know if you know what I'm about to say, but the pace and the entertainment value was not where they wanted to be. Maybe it was boring, okay? And so they looked at the situation and they made some rule changes the last couple of years about pitch time or things like that. And it worked. They analyzed what was going to help. They made changes. And the game is more exciting, you know, pretty well accepted. I think that same model is what we're doing now. And I say we because I'm a consultant for Major League Baseball. But I think we're doing that approach now. We're brainstorming right now about what changes can be made to make baseball safer for the players. I can't really talk too much, but some of the leading ideas are going to be explored, and I think there will be some changes that will hopefully help the situation.
Well, I certainly appreciate the impact that you're having, and I would just like to see, you know, as a fan who remembers watching, you know, even guys like Jamie Moyer, certainly a Greg Maddux, a Tom Glavine, I would like to see pitchers, and there are some in the big leagues now that little leaguers can look up to, a pitcher who is not a flamethrower, but gets soft contact, gets guys out, gives up singles and not extra base hits. I feel like there are a few players. Shota from the Cubs comes to mind, and Kyle Hendricks for quite a long career with the Cubs, a favorite of mine. But yeah, I would like to see more of those guys that a young kid can say, I want to learn how to pitch like that.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, not only do the fans want to see a role model, a pitcher who could throw different types of pitches like that, fans want to see a role model, a pitcher who pitches the whole game. I mean, right now, a fan watches a game, and by the sixth inning, neither starter is in it anymore. They just pitched the first half of the game, first five innings or so, five or six innings. So from a safety point of view, I want to help create a situation where players play longer and don't get hurt. But from a entertainment, a fan point of view, you're saying their favorite player and stuff like that. If I pay to go watch a baseball game, I mean, I want to see that pitcher pitch the whole game or most of the game. So I think there are things happening. I want to touch about something else, Dan. You're kind of implying that a guy blows out his elbow, has UCL or Tommy John surgery or some kind of elbow surgery, and his career is over. I just want to touch a little about that, about how realistic that is. On the other hand, some people think your career is not over if you have Tommy John surgery. Some people think that your career will be better or no harm. I just want to diffuse those misconceptions, all right? If you have a Tommy John surgery, life is not over, okay? But on the other hand, you can't say it's nothing. Best case scenario, you're going to take a year and a half off before you're back with your team. A year and a half where, you know, to the sports fan, you disappeared. But to you as a person, you've been doing a lot of physical therapy, rehabilitation, a lot of hard work, working your way back up. It's a hard year and a half of work. Plus, you missed a year and a half of performance of play. So to say it's no big deal at any level is not true, because best case scenario, you miss a year and a half of time. Now, worst case scenario, you don't make it back. Statistically, about 80 to 90% of the people who have a Tommy John surgery do make it back and get back on track. So it's a pretty good surgery. And so people feel okay about it, the players, the teams. But it's not 100%, notice I said 90, 80 to 90% make it back. There are 10 to 20% who don't make it back or have to have another surgery or have to call it quits. So it's not a nothing thing. You do have to have some recovery time. There have been some advances in surgery. When I say Tommy John surgery, that's what's known as UCL reconstruction, which is what Dr. Job did on Tommy John and what Dr. Andrews did on thousands of pitchers and other doctors as well. And Tommy John surgery or UCL reconstruction is you tear the UCL in your elbow, and then the doctor takes another part of your body, a tendon out of your forearm or out of the back of your leg, and puts it in, and you have a surgery where that is a replacement or reconstruction, replaces the torn UCL. That takes about a year and about 14 months on average to make it back, 14 months. Maybe a full year and a half before your performance is as good. There's been some advances now. Instead of a full UCL reconstruction, a full Tommy John surgery, is what's called a UCL repair with an internal brace, meaning it cuts your recovery time about in half. And that's because instead of replacing the torn ligament, they're repairing it. They're putting this internal brace, which is kind of a brace, it's kind of almost like a biological Band-Aid, putting it in there to help it repair. And that's had pretty good success rates, and the return time is half. So that's a big advance in sports medicine. Everyone can't have that, because sometimes the UCL ligament is just totally torn and there's nothing to repair. You have to replace it with a reconstruction. But in some cases, you can have the surgery, which makes the situation a little better.
Dr. Fleissig, with all your years at ASMI, and speaking of athletes that have had to spend upwards of 12 months or more than 12 months rehabilitating. You've actually probably seen these guys at some of their emotional lows and trying to get back up, and they've got their wife, their partner, trying to be there for them, but some pretty tough days for those guys.
Yeah, yeah. I'm old enough. I've been here a long time. You know, we started ASMI back in the 1980s, and about 5 years in, there was this baseball player who also played football, and he blew out his hip. He's a local guy, and his name is Bo Jackson, and he had to do his rehabilitation. And I remember this. He's talking about the road back, and it's real people skills. You know, Bo was a baseball and football all-star. He blew out his hip being tackled in football. But watching him do his rehabilitation, it's hard work. It's not an easy job physically and emotionally. We're fortunate here in Birmingham. We have, I consider, the best physical therapist, a guy named Dr. Kevin Wilk. And he's essentially been with me and with Dr. Andrews and Dr. Dugas and all these doctors over the years. And he's kind of the leader. And so an athlete coming back from a surgery, there are really three key people. It's the doctor, it's the physical therapist, and it's the athlete. And they all have a lot of work to do. And they got to work together as a team to succeed.
One thing I like that you said, and I'll probably mention this at the top of the episode when I go back. Folks, please check out Dr. Fleissig's appearance on the Book of Joe episode, which aired April of last year. That's with Joe Maddon, World Series championship manager, as a manager and as a coach, I think, with the Angels, and then manager with the Cubs, and Tom Verducci. A lot of good takeaways on that episode. What we're talking about here, I kind of wanted to plug this in because there may be, you know, a young man listening to the show or a dad who's got a high school athlete, and all they've been doing is trying to get their velocity up the past few years, and they're maybe on the cusp of college ball. And so they're listening and maybe thinking, well, this is what I've been doing. I like where you said a big thing is if you're pitching and you feel like you're getting fatigued, that's the decision point. I mean, obviously Skip's got to give you the hook, and that helps. But if you can't, you probably need to signal and say, hey, I can't go back out there.
Yeah. You know, Dan, absolutely. I've said that before. And scientifically, there's a lot of things we can measure. We can measure what your elbow angular velocity is. We can measure what your knee angle is, things like that. But measuring fatigue, we've figured out that fatigue is the number one indicator for when a pitcher is about to get seriously hurt. But there's no fatigometer. There's no exact fatigue measurement. It's a very subjective thing, but it's a real thing. And so our science has shown that, well, what fatigue is, Dan, is it's your body telling your brain that something's a little off, okay? Whether it's your heart and you're tired or your muscles or your ligaments. So our athletes have got to listen to their brain. I don't think I really want a baseball pitcher on the mound thinking, I wonder if I'm tired, or maybe I need to tell the coach I'm tired. No, I really think it's the pitching coach's or the manager's job to have his eyes out that this pitcher is tired. I think it's the pitcher's job when his mind frame is out of the game, after the game, later that day, the next day, to tell his parents, to tell the coach, hey, something feels wrong, not keep it a secret. I don't want the pitcher thinking about that while he's playing. I want the coach watching him. But I want the player to give the feedback the next day, later that day, and that'll help. Essentially, if you could figure out an injury early, we could solve it the easy way with a little rest and rehab. If you ignore it and let it become the big injury, then we got a big problem. I want to talk about something else, Dan. You're talking about that podcast I did with Joe Maddon and Tom Verducci, two good guys. I like them. I'm enjoying doing stories like podcasts like with you here, but I'm also enjoying being on Instagram right now. And I have, I'm posting these 1 minute videos on Instagram, and my handle there is my name, or The Biomechanical Man. So that's my Instagram name, is The_Biomechanical_Man. And what I'm trying to do is post 1 minute videos, take home messages about pitching biomechanics or other things. And if I may, I want to talk a little about what pitching biomechanics is, because that's a lot of what I've been going back and forth. That's really my thing. And pitching biomechanics, or biomechanics, bio is like biology, you know, humans and stuff, and mechanics is like physics. So when I started with Dr. Andrews in the 1980s, meaning I'm old now, we were the only show in town, and biomechanics is taking computers and cameras and trying to study how humans throw or run or do things, and using the laws of physics to figure out if their body could handle it, all right, or what's the best way to do it. And now I'm happy to say that our biomechanics at ASMI here in Birmingham has led to biomechanics kind of being generally accepted throughout sports and baseball. And a lot of the teams have a biomechanist or biomechanics equipment as well. The teams have, they used to all send their people to me, their players to me here in Birmingham. But now instead they've hired people who worked for me in the past or other people, and they have equipment. And biomechanics is now a part of sports, baseball in particular. You know, we know teams have always had coaches. And then when Moneyball came along, teams started hiring data analytics people to figure out on-base percentage and things like that. But now teams are hiring to really study the science of the athlete moving. And what biomechanics does in our baseball pitching, we could analyze a pitcher, break it down. How much did he bend his knee? When did he rotate his hips? How much does his shoulder rotate back and arm rotate back at the shoulder? How much force is on the elbow? And we could also see, having studied thousands of pitchers, including a dozen Cy Young Award winners or other top pitchers, we could see that these are the physics that lead to maximum performance without high risk of injury. And it's a beautiful thing that biomechanics, I mean, I love it, that biomechanics is now part of how we're trying to help everyone from major leaguers to little leaguers stay on the field and be as good as they can.
And I love how you said on the episode with Joe and Tom that it really is great that a lot of major league teams have a biomechanist on the payroll, but a even bigger thing is that they're communicating, that you had this intra-department communication taking place. And so some teams, I guess, are taking advantage of that, and some people kind of stay in their little silos, I guess, as you said.
You know, yeah, if you step aside and you wonder why some baseball or football or basketball organizations win often and some are always saying better luck next year, the ones that are doing well, all the teams have team doctors and coaches and maybe biomechanists. But the teams that are doing well are the teams with, like you're just saying, have good communication. And it seems so obvious, like, duh, of course you want the teams. But these teams are big companies, multi-million-dollar companies with a lot of employees. And so sometimes a team does not run as perfectly as it should. But the teams that do well, they, you know, biomechanics is a measurement. And the biomechanics information has to get into the head of the coaches so the coaches can use it as a tool to enhance what they're doing with their players. And that's the way it works when it works well.
Going back to the injuries and, you know, how do we reverse this trend? As I've heard, I know my dad has said it before, nobody's going to do anything until they start feeling some pain. And that may apply to a product that you use or a service that you use. And you want to, that's enough. I'm switching from Comcast to whatever. And so I was astounded. I think Tom Verducci pointed out that, I'm looking at my notes here, there was a $400+ million figure, the cost of some of these guys on the injured list across Major League Baseball. Maybe that was for the 2022 season. I feel like that the monetary cost would be a factor in driving change.
Exactly. Exactly. You're paying a lot of money for players who are not playing. And also, you're not winning games. You're losing games by not having them. So it's a double whammy. If a guy's injured, you still have to pay him. Wasted money. But also, your team's going to lose. So, I think, like, that's why I'm saying I'm encouraged. I think teams, they're not stupid. They're going to try to stop doing that. What's not working. Plus, like I said, I believe in the near future, we're going to have some more rules or guidelines to help people stay safer. And you know, Dan, again, I'm just as concerned with that high school pitcher down the road as that major league pitcher on TV. And so it's a problem up and down the chain. But I think with science, I think we're going to get there. Just like a generation ago, or 15 years ago, we switched to pitch counts that helped in the short term. I think there's going to be something coming along. We're going to try to make baseball safer while people could still succeed.
Dr. Fliasek, I want to make sure I mention this as well. You're also chair of USA Baseball Medical and Safety Advisory Committee.
Well, I'm not the chair. I stepped down. I'm on the committee. Someone else has taken on the role. But USA Baseball, yes, I'm on the medical committee. And USA Baseball is really the umbrella for all of amateur baseball, from youth baseball up to international competition, like Olympic-type competition. And so there's a lot of issues there, and we want to make it safer, basically, for the player development.
Before we wrap up, always on Dan time, I like to ask some kind of light, fun questions. And going way back to when you're 7, 8, 9 years old, I understand you grew up in New York. Mets fan.
Yes. When I was seven, they won the World Series for the first time in 1969. Unfortunately, they've only won it once since then.
That was the amazing Mets.
And yes.
That was also the first year. Was it after the 68 season that they lowered the pitcher's mound?
Yes. Yes.
And
the year of the pitcher. Yeah, exactly.
But any special memories, gosh, being 7 years old, I've been a Cubs fan since I was 10. And so I was watching the 88 season, kind of maybe the second half, but I was all in 89. We won the division, and I was heartbroken when we lose in the NLCS to the Giants. And I remember hearing from my friend's mom, she said, well, just wait till next year. Well, next year turned into 1990 to 91, 92. And I would have loved to have been a 7 or 8 year old kid watching a World Series victory, so I had to wait till my 30s. But any special memories at Shea Stadium or just players that you liked back then?
Oh, of course, of course. You know, I lived in the suburbs of New York, and my brother and I, my brother's 1 year younger, and my sister's 5 years younger, but my brother and I remember fondly my mom and dad and I, and my brother and sister going out to the Shea Stadium, which was a trek. It was an hour and a half away, and watching. It was a rowdy crowd back in those days. And favorite players were, of course, Tom Seaver on the Mets. But I remember a lot of slim years after that in the 1970s. Quickly, the Mets became pretty bad in the early 70s. but yeah. Anyway, I want to talk about real quickly about that 1968 year with the lowering of the mound. What happened was a few years ago, just 5 years ago, Major League Baseball discussed with me and others about possibly lowering the mound again or even moving the mound farther back, because we were in a situation where, you know, you and I started this conversation here talking about pitchers pitching 100 miles per hour. Pitchers have been throwing faster with more spin and more break over the last so many years. And frankly, the offense numbers have gone down, and that's part of why baseball became a little slower to watch. And so some of the things we considered was, you know, it worked in 1968, lowering the mound. Should we lower the mound again or move it farther back? So we actually did some biomechanics studies for Major League Baseball. We studied some college-level pitchers pitching from mounds of different height. We studied pitching at different distances and everything like that. And we figured out, because in 1968, when they made the change, believe it or not, they did not consult with me because I was just a 7-year-old kid, okay? but I assume nowadays it's much more of a legal thing. You don't want people to get hurt, and you want to make sure it's going to work scientifically. So you have to make sure everything passes the smell test. And so we did some studies, and we showed that if you lowered the mound or if you moved the mound farther back, it would not increase the stress on the arm. So therefore, it kind of gave Major League Baseball the go-ahead to explore whether they want to do that for a performance point of view, to even things up for the batters. They did not do that. They decided to do other changes, such as regulate how much sticky stuff you could put on the ball, and also get rid of this shift about the infielders here and there, three infielders on this side. So I just want to point out, we're talking about the 60s when I was a little kid, compared to now, they did reconsider some of these changes, changes like this, but decided not to do it at this time.
And the pitch clock, I think wherever people fall on that, seems to be some acceptance at this point. Maybe I think there might be some confusion, or people like to argue that that may be a driver of these injuries. And I understand there's some evidence that it's not.
You are correct. You understand correctly, Dan. You've done your homework. Again, like I'm saying, Major League Baseball doesn't say, let's try this. They developed it through the minor leagues and through some amateur semi-professional leagues. So it was all tested out previously. And then so far, the data in Major League Baseball, again, I'm with a group and we've been looking at this, the injury rates did not bump up or down noticeably in 2023 with the introduction of the pitch timer. So, you know, we might need more years to know for sure, but so far it does not look like the pitch timer had an effect, good or bad, for injuries. It's not the solution for injuries. It was kind of the solution for entertainment without being a factor one way or the other as far as safety.
Well, I was one that thought that I would not, well, I was not in favor of the pitch clock. I just fundamentally believed that there should be no clocks in baseball. And I'm surprised to admit that I think I like it. I think it is an enjoyable viewing experience. You're not wondering how long it's going to take for the batting gloves to get adjusted or for the pitcher to circle the mound and grab the rosin bag. And I think it is an enjoyable experience.
Yeah, and like anything, it's a learning curve for you as the fan, but for the players, the umpires, it's been a learning curve. But I agree, it's been going well.
And like you said, I want to reemphasize the Instagram page because I checked it out before our conversation. Some great material there. I love that you're really involved with the young athletes. And I'm sure this is a great takeaway for them and how you're able to kind of show their performance and biomechanics. How much fun has that been?
Yeah. You know, I like working with the pros. Why wouldn't I, right? But I really like working with these young kids. I mean, as young as 10 and a lot of high school and college and helping them. And it's really easy to see how you affected their lives. And so to see these guys and see how they can improve and the parents and see how they're happy campers with good information. And again, what I'm just trying to do is, I mean, baseball is a great game, like you said. And I just want people to be able to play it and enjoy it and be safe.
Well, it is still America's pastime. Dr. Fleissig, I thank you so much for your impact on the game that you've already had. But I feel like because of your leadership, your stewardship, that pitchers and athletes in the future are going to be well served. And hopefully we can change or stop the trajectory of these injuries and protect the national pastime for many, many generations to come.
Yes. Thanks for those nice words, Dan. And I'm trying, and I hope I live up to I'm not named Dan, but I hope I live up to the standard of the high Dan standards. And we're trying to make baseball safer for everyone. I also want to point out that we're trying to get a lot of information out to parents and coaches through either coming to ASMI or Instagram or our website. But we're also trying to help the doctors and coaches, the doctors be better, and the physical therapists. We do a lot of training programs at ASMI. A lot of the team doctors trained from ASMI or came to our annual course. And recently, we also even are starting to work with Major League Baseball's diversity pipeline and trying to get more underrepresented people to advance their careers in sports medicine, whether in biomechanics or physicians. So I think making baseball safer in the future has to do with us changing rules, whether it's USA Baseball or Little League Baseball or Major League Baseball. But it also has to do with upping the game of all the sports medicine doctors and biomechanists and everyone else out there. And I'm really happy to be involved.
Can you talk a little bit about MLB at Rickwood Field in June of this year and ASMI's presence there?
Sure, sure. So I reached out to a friend of mine who works with Major League Baseball. They have what's called a diversity pipeline. He's the director of that program. His name is Ty Brooks. And this is I don't remember how long ago, but I said, I want to try to help get more opportunities for people who are not like you and me, Dan, not like a couple of white guys, just people of other backgrounds who really haven't made big inroads into sports medicine. And so I was talking with Ty and trying to figure out what we could do. And we came up with the idea that there was a Major League Baseball game coming to Birmingham, Alabama, June of 2024, just 2 months ago. And so we said, let's do an event kind of in association with that, where we could do a training program and a career advancement. Well, then good fortune came our way with the focus of the Major League Baseball game became a celebration of the Negro Leagues, which was a wonderful tie-in with what we were trying to do, which was trying to, you know, the Negro Leagues is essentially celebrating the past, but what I'm trying to do is make a better future, okay? And so the tie-in was perfect, where we had a workshop, a two-day workshop for the 2 days before that baseball game. We had, I believe, about 25 applicants we picked out of about 75 who applied, or so I don't remember the exact numbers. These were all young people. Yeah, everyone's young compared to me now, but young people starting their career in sports medicine, underrepresented groups, and we did some training program. And then we took them all to the Rookwood game. I talking to my friends, it was the hottest ticket in town, and they're like, oh, do you have a ticket to the game? I'm like, I'm taking a group of 30 people to the game. And they're like, anyway. So we took them all to the game. It was a great experience. And then the day after, I took them all to the Civil Rights Institute here in Birmingham. I don't know if you've been there because you're from here.
Yeah.
So really a wonderful little gem in Birmingham. It's across the street from the 16th Street Baptist Church. And so after celebrating a Major League Baseball game in Birmingham, the next day we went back and revisited history. And it was very somber, actually. And you got to remember the past. And Birmingham is a wonderful community now. But I don't know if I would say that, 60, 70 years ago. And it was a good reminder of where we were so we could learn from history. Anyway, so I'm just trying to help the future and use what position I am in now to try to help people get going in sports medicine.
That's wonderful. I've been to a number of Rookwood Classics before I moved from Birmingham, and had the good fortune of meeting a former Negro League player, Cowboy Atterbury. This is a few years before he passed away, and I love the coming together of the community at the Rookwood Classic, and I wish I could have been at that game as well. Really, I've just so enjoyed your appearance here today. We were talking before we started about, I've got the Moneyball book and you do as well. Do you have a favorite baseball or sports book?
I do like Moneyball a lot, by the way. So I'm very knowledgeable about that. That's the story of the Oakland A's about 20 years ago, looking at things different ways. But that's about the year 2000. Not only was Billy Beane the focus of Moneyball, trying to figure out about data analytics, but the Oakland A's were really one of the first teams to start using biomechanics, as it turns out. So I know a lot of the guys in that book. Rick Peterson was the pitching coach for the Oakland A's. He started his career in the 1980s or 90s as the Birmingham Barons pitching coach here before he made it big as a pitching coach. And so a lot of the guys, a lot of Moneyball you think is just they figure out the analytics, but in fact, the Oakland A's brought Barry Zito and Tim Hudson, some of those pitchers, to ASMI when we were in our early years, and we used biomechanics on their team. So it's a wonderful book. Michael Lewis, I've met him. He came to Birmingham. It's a wonderful book. Became a great movie also. And so that might be my favorite baseball book.
And out of the baseball movies, you know, Field of Dreams, The Natural, or The Rookie, do you have a baseball movie that's a favorite?
Maybe Field of Dreams.
Yeah.
Maybe Field of Dreams. How about you?
Hard to beat that one. I really love The Rookie and Field of Dreams. It's kind of depends on when you were to ask me. I might have I really got to sit down and watch The Natural again. So that came out before my time.
I also like fun movies, and I actually made a list of my favorite movies of all time. But I like some of the fun movies, and I don't remember the exact name of the movie, but there's one movie where some little kid hurts his arm, and then he has surgery on his arm, and they make it too tight or whatever, and then I could throw like 100 miles per hour. And he said, "Oh, Little Big League." Maybe it's
Little
called
Big
Little
League.
Big. And I like that movie because it's so far-fetched compared to, I mean, I don't, in our sports fans, we cannot do that. It's just such a far-fetched concept that I find that movie kind of funny.
Well, since it's Dan time, I wrote down a couple names real quick. I'm sure you remember Dan Quisenberry,
Sure.
regarded as probably one of the better submariner. Got
Submarine.
a lot of weak
Yeah.
contact.
Submarine pitcher. Yeah, for sure.
I wrote down some other names, some non-Dans though. Don Sutton.
Don is close enough to Dan, I guess he figured. Dan Quisenberry and Kent DeColvey were the two submarine pitchers in the 70s or 80s. And I just want to point out that we've studied a lot of pitching mechanics in our lab, sidearm, three-quarter, overhand. A question that comes up a lot, Dan, is one safer or more effective way than the other? Well, it turns out it's not a yes or no answer, that there's a safe and correct way to be a submarine pitcher or a sidearm pitcher. Or overhand pitcher, they all have a safe way. And one of the things that's important, regardless of your style, is that your what's called abduction angle or your armpit angle has to be proper. So whether you're throwing high or low, your throwing elbow essentially needs to be on an imaginary line of your two shoulders at the time of your release. So if you're a typical pitcher, your glove side is dropped down and your arm is up, but your elbow's still on that imaginary line. If you're one of these submarine guys, your throwing shoulder is actually lower than your glove shoulder, glove side shoulder, but still your elbow needs to be on those lines. It works for the laws of physics, and it also works for the laws of anatomy, how our bodies are built. So Dan Quisenberry is an example of an extreme pitching, but it worked because he followed those rules.
Yeah, I'm sure you have you seen some pitchers with a UCL injury, and they've got a very unorthodox pitching style, and you have to say, how did you get this far? How did nobody stop you from
Well, we see a lot of guys who have been hurt, and then we see something funky in their mechanics. Then we try to figure out whether they've always done that or whether this has been a compensation from having an injury. Anyway, we try to get them on the path. But just as much, Dan, or even more, we find a healthy pitcher who's never been hurt, who has something bad, and we're like, hey, dude, this is a red flag. You need to change this. Or else do something else for your life because you're an injury waiting to happen. So that's I like doing that. I don't like giving people bad news, but I like telling people that here's something to do to make yourself better.
Well, as you can tell, and if folks, if you've been listening to Dan Time for somebody out there has been here the whole ride, all 52 weeks. As you know, sometimes I've got more questions in the tank. I've got some that I rattle off the top of my head, but I hope it's for your delight and your benefit. And Dr. Fliesick here has just been just an outstanding guest. I so appreciate your time. If we didn't have to break for lunch or try to get out in front of rush hour traffic, maybe we'd talk for another hour.
It was my pleasure to be your guest number 52. So that makes one full year. Congratulations to you.
Thank you so much, and hope to have you on again in the future. This will always be a topic of relevance, and thank you for being at the forefront.
My pleasure.
Remember, follow Dr. Fliesick on Instagram.
I think Instagram is the best, and also our website, asmi.org.
That's it for this episode of Dan Time. We'll see you next Sunday on the Dan Time podcast. Thank you, Dr. Fliesick.
My pleasure.